You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Buongiorno a tutti, presentiamo questa mattina una delle ultime pubblicazioni della casa editrice Tabula Fati, che ho l'onere di dirigere. E felice l'occasione di presentare un'altra ulteriore opera del nostro presidente, di Donato Altomare, che grazie alla sua stima aiuta a aumentare la mia autostima e anche la preziosità del catalogo delle edizioni Tabula Fati. E noi abbiamo diverse collane, una dedicata alla fantascienza, una dedicata al fantastico, un'altra dedicata al fantasy. Stiamo ripubblicando l'opera omnia, una parte, il ciclo delle Amazzoni di Zuddas. Manca ancora un volume da pubblicare, altre sono le iniziative, ci sono nuove autrici, nuovi autori, insomma diamo un nostro piccolo contributo con 3-4 pubblicazioni l'anno, diciamo, a aumentare la proposta del fantasy e della fantascienza in Italia, chiaramente obbligando tutti gli scrittori della casa editrice a iscriversi alla WORD, perché è necessario che questa nostra associazione sia la più ampia possibile, la più rappresentativa possibile. E nei libri di questi ultimi anni, sulle copertine, ho anche messo il marchio della WORD SF, non abbiamo ancora quantizzato le royalty che toccano, quindi prima o poi
insomma, 5 euro a parola.
5 euro a parola sarà un centesimo a ogni o l'1% su ogni copia venduta, sì, e pagata. Poi vabbè, non so se esiste un tariffario.
Sapete che uno dei modi
devi parlare al microfono. Io lo sto facendo.
Parla
tu al microfono. No, tu devi parlare al microfono.
Uno dei modi della WORD di recuperare qualche cosa è proprio con il logo, non lo sapete.
E quindi però non c'è una contabilizzazione, comunque la dobbiamo fare. Comunque sto utilizzando il marchio Word per le pubblicazioni ufficiali della casa editrice. Allora, vuoi iniziare con un passaggio del nuovo libro?
Passaggio, velocemente un raccontino. Si chiama La gabbia. Questo non è prettamente di fantascienza, ma per darvi un'idea di quello che andrete a leggere, poi entreremo nel merito. La gabbia. Quante volte l'avevo odiata? Quante volte la mia mano si era chiusa a pugno, stringendosi sino a far sbiancare le nocche? Quante volte ero stato costretto a girare il capo per non fare ciò che il mio cuore mi ordinava? La gabbia era lì, che troneggiava su un mobile antipatico quanto lei stesso, scuro, pesante, vecchio, non antico. Parevano entrambi prendersi gioco di me, della mia angoscia nel vedere quei piccoli esseri viventi costretti a passare tutta la loro vita rinchiusi in una stretta prigione. Sì, dorata quanto si vuole, accuditi, puliti, sfamati, sino all'ingordigia, ma pur sempre prigionieri. La casa di mia madre era in un paesino tranquillo del sud Italia e quella casa era tutto per lei, per noi. Da quando mio padre era morto andando giù col peschereccio, la nostra vita era mutata drasticamente. Quella gabbia ne era il simbolo e in qualche modo la ragione. Era stato l'unico regalo di mio padre. Da allora era diventato un oggetto di culto per mia madre. Per lei dentro c'era l'anima di mio padre. La sua presenza irrinunciabile, oserei dire la sua immanenza. Io non sopportavo veder nessuno costretto in gabbia, fossero bestie, uomini, uccelli, nessuno, perché la libertà è il più sacro dei doni che Dio ci ha dato. La libertà di muoversi, di andare in qualsiasi posto, fare quello che si vuole, senza intaccare la libertà degli altri. E questo forse perché io stesso mi sentivo in gabbia. Gabbia era l'amore di mia madre che aveva riversato su di me tutte le sue attenzioni. Mi sentivo in gabbia a scuola, dove le sbarre erano gli sguardi dei miei professori che dicevano devi fare questo, devi fare quell'altro, gabbia erano le mie tasche sempre senza un centesimo, e i tentativi spesso patetici di mia madre di farmi credere che non avessimo problemi economici. Gabbia era stata per un certo tempo Stefania, quella ragazzina viziosa che passava da un letto all'altro soltanto per dimostrare che era una donna. Il mio mondo era fatto di sbarre, così passavo il tempo a guardare quella gabbia. Poi una notte c'era un forte vento che mi aveva impedito di dormire. Continuavo a girarmi e a rigirarmi nel letto, in un'insonnia che si ingigantiva. E la mia mente fu ancora catturata dalla gabbia. Pensai di tutto, poi alla fine decisi. L'alba avanzò, spinta dal vento impetuoso, e giunse prima del solito. Mi alzai muovendomi come un gatto, i miei piedi sfioravano il pavimento, in quel momento ero soltanto teso che sarei riuscito persino a camminare sui carboni ardenti. Raggiunsi la stanza da letto di mia madre, sbirciai dentro, dormiva. Ma la gabbia continuava a imporsi orrenda, la finestra era vicinissima, oltre c'era il cielo, la spalancai. E lo stesso feci con la persiana. Una zaffata d'aria fresca mi convinse che stavo facendo la cosa giusta, che stavo dando una scossa alla mia vita, alla nostra vita. In alto alcune rondini garrirono il loro richiamo. Presi la gabbia, generando sorpresa un piccolo trambusto al suo interno. Tra un attimo avrete la libertà, pensai, la libertà. Posai la gabbia sul davanzale e emisi un profondo sospiro. L'alba parve fermarsi per un infinito istante a osservarmi. Sollevai le mani, aprii la porticina. Andate, via, fuori, uscite, esclamai a bassa voce. Non accadde nulla. Ho detto che potete andare, possibile che non lo capite? Potrete rincorrervi tra gli alberi, potrete decidere se dormire o no, se mangiare o no, insomma, su, andate via. Nulla. Scossi la gabbia, l'agitai sperando di scuotere anche loro, sventagliai le mani cercando di far paura, nulla, mi venne da piangere, tanto coraggio sprecato per nulla, nulla. Sollevai le spalle, rimisi la gabbia a posto e tornai a letto. Del resto che cos'altro avrei potuto aspettarmi da delle tartarughe?
Grazie.
Questo è un tipo particolare, ma quello su cui vorrei puntare l'attenzione è che mi sono divertito a giocare, ecco, giocare nel senso buono, con i maggiori personaggi della fantascienza italiana, a cominciare dal presente Lippi. Praticamente anni fa, molti anni fa, scrissi un pezzo comico che si chiamava Memorial Day, che feci leggere ad Ernesto, il quale si sganasciò letteralmente dalle risate. L'ho fatto leggere anche al buon Curtoni, il quale mi scagliò addosso una bestemmia, non una bestemmia, una parolaccia, ma a denti stretti, nel quale immagino che in un futuro molto lontano, sia stato creato il cosiddetto Club dei 99, cioè i 99 maggiori esponenti della fantascienza italiana si sono riuniti e hanno come scopo di ogni anno di celebrare un autore estraneo ai 99. Il problema è che questi 99, dopo centinaia e centinaia di anni, si sono ridotte soltanto 6 o 7 componenti, i quali vivono grazie a protesi, a particolari aggiunte al loro fisico, e ciascuno dei quali ha tutta una serie di connotazioni. Non voglio andare nello specifico, ma vi assicuro che è una cosa divertentissima. Ho preso pacatamente in giro, quindi non ho offeso nessuno, infatti tutti quelli che l'hanno letto lo hanno ammesso. Al di là del mega Big Ernest, che è il capo di tutti e che decide lui le cose da fare, ho preso graziosamente in giro il buon Giuseppe Lippi, il buon Gianfranco De Turris, poi Silvio Sossio, Curtoni, ciascuno legandolo ad una propria connotazione. A te ti farà divertire come un pazzo, te lo garantisco, che cosa mi sono legato al Lupo Alberto, poi vedrai, e anche come si chiama, Ugo Malaguti, divertendomi con lui quando fece venire Miss Universo ad un convegno di fantascienza, non so chi se lo ricorda, e insomma questo è, diciamo, il corpo più importante. Poi ci sono racconti inediti per gli amanti dei gatti, non lasciatevi scappare l'ultimo racconto, che si chiama Tano il poeta, perché appunto riguarda il mondo dei gatti, e poi ci sono, ho dovuto ripescare un paio di vecchi racconti che sono introvabili, perché Allegro ma non troppo fu pubblicato dal bravo Marco in un dunque Solfanelli, sì,
cioè era tuo padre,
sì. Era Marino Solfanelli, in la risata di Dio, un volumetto che credo per me sia stata una pietra miliare importantissimo, che però ovviamente è introvabile, nel senso che o ve lo regalo io o non lo avrete da nessun'altra parte, e accetto anche prenotazioni, mentre quindi un paio pubblicati su delle fanzine, e alcune ho dovuto porre rimedio, per esempio ad una malvezzo dell'amico, amico non lo vedo da una vita, Gianni Pilo, il quale aveva la brutta abitudine di cambiare i titoli dei racconti, e un mio racconto cambiò il titolo, adesso l'ho riproposto col titolo originale, mi fece incazzare, ma lui è un altro di quelli presi graziosamente in giro, e niente, questo è, vi posso soltanto dire una cosa, è in pratica la Padella 2, per chi si ricorda tempo fa ho pubblicato con Delos un'antologia di racconti si chiamava E la padella disse. Questo titolo nasceva da un mio racconto breve, ma il titolo era lungo. Il titolo era «E la padella disse attento a non cadere mentre la brace sogghignava», un po' l'interpretazione di passare dalla padella alla brace, e che era il classico patto col diavolo con un finale, credo, assolutamente imprevedibile. Di lì fu fatta un'antologia di racconti umoristici, ironici. Ho avuto decine di ringraziamenti di persone che mi hanno detto: guarda, sono tornato a casa la sera stanco, esausto, per fortuna che c'avevo il libro, così ho preso un pochettino, mi sono un po' divertito. Padella. Poi da parecchio stavo pensando proprio a riproporre un secondo, e questo si chiama La congrega dell'avvoltoio. Dalla copertina capirete a cosa si riferisce, perché ci sono costatine di maiale, salsicce, cioccolate, pesce, eccetera, e capirete a cosa si riferisce la congrega dell'avvoltoio, che è retto da uno slurp supremo lardoso unico regnante sui pasti, e che gioca un pochettino molto sul cibo e sulla nostra pessima abitudine di mangiare forse un po' troppo. E io faccio il mio bravo mea culpa.
Sì, beh, insomma, mi hai tolto qualche domanda nel tuo profluvio. È vero che nell'ambito della fantascienza, insomma, non queste operazioni sono un po', diciamo, guardate con sogghigno, insomma, oppure storcendo il naso, perché tutti noi siamo, vogliamo sempre rappresentare una fantascienza di elevata qualità, giustamente, ne abbiamo tutti gli strumenti, però ogni tanto qualcuno si diverte a buttare questo sasso nello stagno, sì. Non per diatriba, ma per creare un disincanto nei confronti del nostro mondo.
Sì, ma ti rispondo molto volentieri. Prima di tutto, purtroppo ho avuto la percezione, sentendo molti non appassionati, che la fantascienza spesso è associata ad un risvolto negativo. Molti hanno sempre pensato che quando ho pubblicato, ho vinto con Mater Maxima il premio Urania, ho avuto tanti commenti positivi e ne sono particolarmente orgoglioso. L'unico commento negativo è stato di un critico, il quale mi ha detto: bello, scritto bene, eccetera, interessante, però peccato che finisce bene. Ora, il dramma, io credo, il dramma oggi della fantascienza è che deve essere esclusivamente drammatica, oddio, non solo della fantascienza, ma credo anche di altro genere di letteratura. Pensate ai maggiori successi, se non ci sono drammi. Invece io dico, ragazzi, sorridiamo con la fantascienza, sorridiamo col fantastico, sorridiamo. Del resto ci sono dei grandi autori americani che ci hanno preceduto da questo punto di vista. E io dico sempre, perché la fantascienza deve dare soltanto un'immagine di buio, di futuro negativo, di pessimismo?
Perché è legata alla realtà.
Va bene, d'accordo. Perciò, allora, se la fantascienza continua così, non è più fantascienza.
Invito perché... anche qualcuno a fare delle domande, quindi, però effettivamente la fantascienza si è fatta carico un po' da sempre, insomma, di indagare il nostro futuro e darci degli scenari purtroppo reali, anche nei momenti e nelle situazioni più catastrofiche. Io penso che ognuno di noi sia convinto, ma anche gli esperti sono convinti che effettivamente la fantascienza è la risposta ai problemi che noi abbiamo attualmente, cioè, perché prefigurare il futuro secondo le basi di oggi, effettivamente ne si può avere solamente una immagine catastrofica.
Sono proprio d'accordo sul fatto che sia uno specchio della realtà. Uno la può vedere così, Però lo specchio della realtà cos'è? Ti vedo la mattina, io spesso sono, non so, insostanziale, non vorrei andare troppo per le lunghe, ma solo dire che la fantascienza, come ogni altra forma di narrativa, è un invento. Ci sono quelli che amano inventare, camuffando meglio il rapporto di medico con la realtà, con i problemi che ci sono, vengono fuori quelle opere problematiche. Ci sono altri che invece la intendono soprattutto come genere fantastico anche lei. Quindi questo non per dire che debba allontanarsi, essere irresponsabile, essere... però
bravo.
È una vita, saranno 50-60 anni che sentiamo da la grande Roberta Rambelli in poi il discorso dell'impegno della fantascienza. È in realtà il vecchio discorso dell'impegno della letteratura, che io personalmente, magari in modo irresponsabile e frivolo, ho più o meno sempre l'impegno della letteratura, però non l'ho lasciato perdere. Quindi quello che dice Donato è un sassolino gettato nel bagno del perché ci siamo avvicinati a questo genere. Perché ci piaceva, quando non avevamo niente da spartire ancora, perché mantenuti, perché appunto beatamente irresponsabili, con le fatiche, i dolori della realtà. E poi voglio concludere dicendo che ci sono fatiche, dolori, eccetera, anche dentro il mondo. Quindi quando più fantastico, più esasperato, tu vai a tirare fuori la figura, che ne so, del mago, eccetera, eccetera, ti riferisci a questa sfera turbolenta che abbiamo dentro, che è bella e che... risolve bellamente così le nostre turbolenze.
Senti, a ulteriore riprova di questo, posso solo parlare della mia esperienza diretta. Sapete che ho pubblicato tantissimo, immeritatamente probabilmente, ma i romanzi che hanno lasciato, cioè dei quali ho avuto commenti, sono romanzi come Vladimir May, tu forse lo ricorderai, che è praticamente un personaggio scanzonato, un personaggio tra l'ironico, il divertente, il menefreghista, eccetera. Cioè un personaggio che è l'antitesi della fantascienza intesa come espressione del futuro, eccetera. E però non solo ne ha tanti, ma addirittura qualcuno, ecco, non dico chi, mi sta costringendo, tra virgolette, a scrivere, a riprendere questo personaggio. Infatti ho scritto quasi tutto il secondo volume, perché io sono convinto che oggi come oggi c'è bisogno un po' di aria fresca, insomma, ragazzi. Aria fresca nella fantascienza, sì, i capolavori non si discutono, i grandi autori, ogni tanto abbiamo bisogno di vedere un film che ci sconvolga o leggere un libro che ci rimanga dentro, ok, d'accordo, però io sul mio comodino c'ho insieme ai vari libri di fantascienza La settimana enigmistica e ogni tanto, oppure Peanuts che sta adesso uscendo, ogni tanto bisogna andare a leggere una striscia per rendermi conto che in effetti il nero non è proprio così nero. Allora, gettiamolo questo sassolino che è leggero, ma spero che abbia diciamo influenza sulla fantascienza italiana, e speriamo che qualcuno, non dico che prenda esempi, ma ci dia una mano a rammentare che scrivere e leggere deve essere prima di tutto un gran divertimento, a prescindere da quello che si scrive, a prescindere da quello che si legga.
Sì.
Comunque la fantascienza anni 50 e anni 60 è una fantascienza ottimistica, era veramente negativa. Dopo le cose hanno negativo.
Il discorso della realtà. Sì. Va bene. Insomma, dico sempre, fino a quando mi divertirò a scrivere, anche allora scriverò tantissimo. Poi quando qualcuno mi dirà finiscila, la smetto, però fino a quando mi diverto vado avanti, anche perché, ripeto, sono personaggi leggeri, distensivi, molto veloci, cioè non personaggi anche che tutto sommato danno anche un'immagine. Vladimir May rappresenta un po' il tra virgolette menefreghismo anche della vita dell'esistenza attuale, cioè il disinteresse completamente della moralità, delle posizioni morali, e quindi il rischio, prendendo in giro tramite Vladimir May, si vuole un po' frustare determinate posizioni, determinati modi di fare, e dimenticandosi che alla fin fine, se siamo esseri umani, dobbiamo opporci al caos. Non lo facciamo perché, vabbè, adesso diventa troppo complicato il ragionamento. Sì, ah, appunto.
Sì, altri interventi? Se non ci sono. Abbiamo adesso 6 minuti, quindi possiamo giocarcelo in 2 maniere. O ci leggi l'incipit di quest'ultimo racconto, oppure parliamo degli altri progetti editoriali che abbiamo in campo, come I Demoni di Sicilia.
Ah, va bene.
Che è un progetto.
Vabbè, penso che della Congrega dell'Avvoltoio abbiamo già abbastanza parlato. Vi posso soltanto dire, ripeto, e chiudo, che i temi trattano, ecco, vi leggo la quarta di copertina.
Posso?
Dunque, a parte la Congrega, che vi ho già detto, che fa del cibo una fede e che è guidata da uno slurp supremo, unico, lardoso, regnante sui pasti. Poi, se dal cielo improvvisamente scendessero delle bolle con dei santi sulla terra, tempo fa Francesco Gatti, un giornalista di Roma, mi disse: devo fare un programma televisivo nel quale devo immaginare che su Roma scendano gli alieni, buttami giù qualche cosa. E io gli lanciai questo fatto, che praticamente dal cielo scendevano questi alieni, che però venivano considerati dei santi, con delle conseguenze che potete immaginare, assolutamente divertentissime. Poi la gabbia, poi il famosissimo discorso degli alieni tra noi, dopo tantissimi ne hanno parlato, ma questo ha una chiave più immediata, più veloce. Sono racconti brevi, a parte Memorial Day, che è il corpo principale, piuttosto corposo, ma gli altri sono racconti brevi. Per esempio, vi spiego perché non possono essere inviate delle sonde su Venere. Voi non lo sapete, ma lo scoprirete leggendo questo raccontino. Se ci sono altre forme, per esempio, voi non sapete che pure il Sole è abitato, lo scoprirete leggendo. Che altro? C'è anche un po' di fantasy, cioè c'è per esempio una storia di succhiasangue. Qualcuno dei vecchi lo conoscerà questo racconto, ma è un racconto simpatico, che è un fantasy tipo maghi e guerrieri, ma sempre in chiave ironica. Il Memorial Day, ne ho già parlato, che altro? Poi c'è Sangue Blu, immaginate che vi state facendo la barba la mattina, vi tagliate e vedete, cioè vi arriva in casa, in bagno, vostra moglie, che c'ha pure lei un taglio, solo che non sanguina rosso, ma sanguina blu. Poi tutte le... E poi concludo, ripeto, che con Tano il poeta gli amanti dei gatti andranno in giù, il brodo di giuggiole, anche perché pure io li amo, anche se non ne posseggo per ragioni troppo lunghe da descrivere. E poi... vuoi parlare tu dei demoni oppure...
No, io conosco le cose che sono già uscite, ne sono usciti 3 volumetti, 3 romanzi brevi.
Sì, e sto scrivendo il quarto, sto quasi finendo il quarto. Praticamente Demoni di Sicilia è un... tempo fa, è ambientato nell'inizio del secolo del Novecento. In pratica, voi non lo sapete, ma la Sicilia poggia su 7 pilastri. 7 pilastri che sono corrosi dall'interno da questi demoni, che tentano di rompere queste colonne per fare affondare la Sicilia, come è successo per una grande isola di cui si va ancora alla ricerca. Esistono dei maghi bianchi che combattono, cioè vanno alla ricerca in maniera molto rocambolesca, perché non sanno dove sono collocati questi pilastri, vanno alla ricerca di questi pilastri e dei per uccidere i rosicchiatori, che sono a loro volta protetti da altre entità malvagie, e si crea uno strano connubio tra un conte, un duca siciliano, di duca di San Severino, cinquantenne, e una giovanissima milanese, Elena Gherardi, che è la figlia di Tommaso Gherardi, il quale aveva una particolare raccolta di oggetti mistici che lui utilizza appunto per combattere questi demoni. Dall'unione di questi due personaggi diametralmente opposti, quindi un uomo del sud attempato, una ragazza del giovanissima, 20 anni, del nord, con idee completamente divergenti, chiaramente c'è tra di loro un rapporto che
cresce.
Adesso non vogliamo entrare troppo nello specifico, ma chiaramente il duca viene attratto da questa ragazza, che tra l'altro ha incredibili capacità, è un'ottima schermitrice e l'aiuta molto in certe situazioni. Ogni episodio era giustamente una eptalogia. I primi tre volumi sono stati pubblicati: Logam del Druido, La Morte Meravigliosa, e il terzo non me lo ricordo. E poi ce ne sono, c'è un quarto che.
Comunque li ho portati.
C'è un quarto che sta e che sono ambientati, ripeto, all'inizio del Novecento. Quindi immaginate un pochettino questo rapporto anche calato in una Sicilia dell'inizio del Novecento. Ho avuto difficoltà anche proprio a creare le ambientazioni. Una cosa importante, e ve lo dico e chiudo l'argomento, è anche collegato al fenomeno sismico. In qualche modo è collegato, tant'è che il primo episodio, che si chiama Logam del Druido, per quei pochi che non sanno cosa sia un ogam, un ogam era una tavolozza di tasso che gli antichi druidi utilizzavano per trovare, nel momento in cui loro dovevano nominare il loro capo, il loro sacerdote supremo, dovevano farlo in un posto dal punto di vista sismico assolutamente quieto, e per farlo utilizzavano questa tavolozza, questo ogam, attraverso la quale si individuavano questi posti. Chiaramente è una tavolozza che storicamente è esistita, non abbiamo tracce perché è estremamente ricercata dagli studiosi, ovviamente, ma non è una mia invenzione, è un fatto che esiste. E questo ogam veniva utilizzato ogni volta per trovare. È chiaro che la storia inizia con l'ogam del druido, poi si va ampliando, e il prossimo, lo dico per chiarezza, si svolge a Palermo, nel convento dei Cappuccini. Chi c'è stato sa che ha una peculiarità particolare, cioè ha tutti i morti appesi alle pareti, e io che ci sono stato, a parte la bambina che sembra morta da pochi giorni, e c'ha oltre più di 100 anni che è morta, queste pareti sono inquietanti, specie con i bambini, anche i neonati morti piccoli, sembrano delle bambole di pezza, fanno una certa impressione. Ok, io ho finito.
Bene, vi ringraziamo, il tempo è abbondantemente scaduto. Bene. Vi invitiamo a rimanere per la prossima presentazione.
State ascoltando Fantascientificast, probabilmente il miglior podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia del quadrante alfa. www.fantascientificast.it. Email redazione@fantascientificast.it.
We'll give this speech in English with Lavi. Thank you for being here at this early hour. Thank you, Lavi, for getting up, even though yesterday was a tough night, right?
bear with me. I haven't had much sleep. So.
Okay. When Flora and Emanuele told me that the guest of honor of the DeepCon 18 would have been Lavi Tidar, I was really happy. Really happy for two reasons. First of all, he's a fine writer. And on top of that, he's been my inspiration when I started the Future Fiction series. Because Lavi Tidar, since 2008, am I right? Yeah? It's since 2008, has been running an excellent world science fiction blog. And he's been scouting and selecting the best voices from all over the world. And he's been publishing them on this very nice EBEX book of world science fiction. I personally think that this is something that we, coming from the non-English speaking countries, must do with strength, with all our power, because of course the English will not let their power go on the worldwide publishing. And the second reason is that maybe less commercial and more idealistic, in the sense that as a reader, when I was starting to read science fiction and then reading more and more over the years, I realized that what is normal in the mainstream genre and in other genres is absolutely missing in the science fiction. If you go in a bookstore, in a library, you can find authors from all over the world, whether it's thrillers, literature, any kind of fiction. But when it comes down to science fiction, this is non-existent. There have been, of course, some good writers published on Urania, for example, that is the main source of non-English. Urania is the main source of everything you might want to find in science fiction. I would like to start a conversation with Lavi on these premises. What has been hampering and limiting the publication of these authors in the science fiction? Because in other genres, this is not a problem, as long as the authors are, you know, recognized in their own countries. But I personally think that we've been publishing too much from two single countries, and we've been publishing too little from all the rest of the world. And when it comes down to quality, I don't think that the best Spanish science fiction author, or the French one, or the German one, is not comparable to any other English or American writer. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's difficult because... Is it working? Yeah. I think it's difficult. I mean, partly because science fiction, the way, you know, when you think of science fiction as science fiction, it's an American genre, you know. Not, you know, if we say speculative fiction, or what John Clute likes to say, fantastica, obviously that's not an American thing. But science fiction specifically, it has this specific tradition of coming from the pulp magazines and corresponding with itself a lot as well. And it used to be that you could read all of science fiction in one go, which is no longer the case. Actually, what I think is quite interesting, you know, for me, I grew up on a lot of the old classics. Mm-hmm. But if you look at people who come into science fiction as writers today, a lot of them don't have any familiarity with those writers at all. And they would start more from, say, Ender's Game, you know, from the 80s. That would have been the book that got people in. So it does change. But, I mean, you know, in terms of the English market, I think it's not just science fiction. I mean, the statistic is that 3% of all books in English are translations. And you think, oh, that doesn't sound too bad. That includes the car manuals and your dishwasher manual. So novels would be a small percentage of 3%.
And that includes all the languages of the world.
Right, and then science fiction would be that tiny little, yes. Dog. So it's really, whereas you think if you're in Italy, if you're in like a, you know, any other normal country, it could be as high as 50% of translations from English and other languages coming in. So it's incredibly frustrating. I think what happened was the internet helped to change. It helped make it more accessible, and I know in Israel in the 90s, for example, the internet helped fans get together and start the first convention and start magazines and so on. And magazines, in turn, encouraged people to write stories for them. Yeah. You know, so that really helped, and it certainly helps in terms of sending your stories. I mean, I started submitting before anyone. Science fiction editors are basically people who, you know, are used to thinking about the future, but they're very resistant to the future. So email, sending stories by email was considered this awful thing that who would do that? I only use paper and pen. So you would have to print out the story in whatever country you're in, and you'd have to go to the post office and get 2 international reply coupons. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever seen them. They're an absolute nightmare. And you'd always have to try and get them. And you'd have to do a stamped, you know, self-addressed envelope. And you'd have to send. So you have to go all through that and send it to some guy in New York just to get a rejection.
So you're saying there are even physical obstacles.
Well, that was a very real obstacle, you know. And I don't think in all the time that I did that, I actually managed to sell a single story. You know, so for me as a writer, I started going with the electronic magazines because I could just send by email. And this is the annoying thing, when I started, they weren't considered respectable, the online magazines. So unless you were published in Asimov's, that didn't count. Now it's the exact opposite.
Yeah, now it's the contrary.
And now is when I've moved to the print magazine, so I'm on the wrong trend.
Yeah.
But I think the internet really helped people like me. It helped people all over the world, really, to make it a bit more democratic to at least try and get published. What happened was, because the translation issue is so big, is you had those younger writers starting to write in English to try and get published more widely.
Yeah, I had an issue with Christopher Priest during the Utopial, because I was in a panel about European science fiction, and he was saying that, oh, you should all turn to English. You have to write in English. You have to publish in English to be recognized on an international scale. And I said, absolutely right, but what happens to our cultures? What happens to our languages? What happens to our identities when we bend our mind to the English culture? We bow our head to the English masters, even if it's just the language. But he had no answer to that, because this is, of course, the biggest problem. Shall we translate or not? It's a riddle. I don't think there's a solution for that. The only solution would be to, I don't know, have a better distribution of stories, and that's something that's the reason why I look up to you when you run the World Science Fiction blog, because even though they were in English, this is the compromise you have to pay for that. But the next phase would be probably to address the problem on a language-to-language translation. I don't know if it's clear, but for example, to have I don't know, maybe it's a dream, maybe it's just my utopian and idealistic view of the things, but Spanish authors translated in French and French author translated in Germans. An exchange of cultures, not just using the English always as the lingua franca of our time, but making it accessible and then going into the original language.
But to be fair, I think that is more common to be translated within Europe than into English. I mean, English is the big barrier. I think with Andrei Sapkowski, he, you know, his success was he's a Polish fantasy writer. To begin with, he was published in Poland, then he was published in Russia, and then France and Spain. He only made it into English after he was already translated into several European languages. So, you know, in Europe, it's a bit more open to that. You know, with Israeli writers, I know that they're published much more widely and are respected more in Europe, whereas to sell to English, even if you do get through the whole process of getting translated and published, half the time no one cares. You know, it's just it's another book.
So my next question is, where do you go to find these stories? Where are now the mark? Where are the magazines, or how do you find these authors? How do you read these stories actually online?
Well, no, I was always just interested in, you know, different traditions of science fiction. So, and I travel a lot. So, whichever country I'd go to, I'd look through the bookshops, and I'll or try and meet people who are writing
and find the same books.
No, well, this is the thing. I mean, you do find these interesting little books, and I just went looking for them. You can always find those strange little publications. And so, for example, the First World SF anthology has a Malaysian writer called Tunku Halim, who's a Malaysian horror writer, really. And the only reason I know this is because I was traveling through Malaysia, you know, 10 years before I did the anthology, and I picked up his book in the 90s. No one even knows who he is in Malaysia because I mention him sometimes. So when I came to do the anthology, and the first one was incredibly hard to do because it's hard to describe how different the situation is now than what it was then. So to do that anthology, I really had to struggle to find anything. And, you know, so he was a guy that I remembered, I emailed, I managed to get in touch with him online and get a story.
And what are the markets now that are open to other voices, to international authors? And
well, everyone says they want stories, you know. It's just that they don't want to make any effort about it. They all say, oh, send me your stories, you know. And the thing is, there's this image of editors as people who sit back, you know, the idea is I'll sit here and you come to me, you know. And my idea of it is I go and I look, I actively look. I don't really want people to come to me because I don't like talking to people, but so I look everywhere, and even with the World SF anthologies, the whole time, you know, I try and keep a sort of spreadsheet or just a document with things that caught my eye and just as possibilities. But obviously, because I've done it for a while, I just have a lot of different.
Is it real hard to pitch the book to an editor? To pitch the book to an editor, is it real hard? How difficult was it to actually get this, you know, stranger, unknown voices to be published on Epics?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the sort of thing that makes no sense to do this anthology. And publishers are very risk averse. This is why we're not seeing translations, because they don't want to spend the money on a book that they haven't read. And might not sell. But I was working with this small publisher called Apex in America. And small publishers are easier sometimes because they can take more chances, they can take more risks. So I emailed him and I said, look, you know, you're not going to make any money on this book. That was my pitch. I said, you're not going to make any money on this. But I just think it's worth doing. And luckily, he agreed, strangely enough. And we honestly thought we would sell, you know, we'd be lucky to sell 200 copies of the book.
Do you have numbers of how much it sold?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it sold more than 200. No, it sold a few thousand copies over the 10 years. So they're not very big numbers.
Yeah.
But people keep buying them. The nice thing is now they've become, you're going to find them in university libraries, which
a
is
milestone.
Really where they should be. and people teach them. They're running courses on international science fiction now and using them. So, but, you know, you wish more people did buy them.
So do you think that the only problem is the cost of translation, given that the quality is fair enough?
I think with books, I think maybe the question is to look at financing models, you know, and in Europe you have funding for translation to some extent. I mean, in Israel they have an institution that will translate at their expense and then try and sell it to America or whatever. But obviously the focus wouldn't be on science fiction and fantasy. With the Andrzej Sapkowski book, I think that was funded by the Polish government, and that's how they managed to get it published. But usually, I think with science fiction, it's always more difficult because the focus would be on your big literary writers to fund rather than some guy who wrote a science fiction novel. But crowdfunding is an interesting option. Now. That's what more and more people are doing.
Yeah. Many people tell me when I publish also the Storie dal domani, which is let's say the same as you did, is there a difference between what we know science fiction is and what they do? So I turn this question to you. I mean, did you see any particular theme, any particular flavor in these non-English fiction? Can you tell if there is a Chinese science fiction, an African science fiction, an Indian science fiction?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer I would have is that it depends if someone comes from science fiction or from outside science fiction. So people who start off as fans and then write science fiction because that's what they like, they tend to write something that is more recognizably American science fiction. I mean, what we do see a lot is people saying, I want to write, you know, science fiction or fantasy or whatever. Like in Israel, I see a lot of people saying, you know, I went to see this comic that they produced in Israel. They were selling it at a convention. And, you know, and it's very rare to find Israeli comics. And that was on its own pretty impressive. I said, what is it? And they said, it's zombies. But they're in Tel Aviv. And I thought, that doesn't change the story. Okay, it's in Tel Aviv, but it's still just a zombie story, you know. And what I've noticed is that the writers who don't come from science fiction necessarily, but are attracted to weird fiction, they're the ones who are producing more interesting work. There's a Greek novel called What Lot's Wife Saw, which was translated in English, and no one really paid it any attention. But I thought was really interesting, and it's sort of a science fiction detective puzzle story, very unusual. And that's the sort of thing you won't see a science fiction writer necessarily do, but is so much. But that's why it's so good to come across it, because it's different, it's new, it's original. So that's what I'm seeing more. But I don't know if you'd have. I don't know if you'd have a local flavor, because the question then becomes, how much am I putting in local flavor just to appeal to the English reading market, you know?
Well, but for example, in your science fiction book, The Central Station, it's full of references to your culture, so it's impossible to escape them.
Yeah, but then I am writing for this American market, though. So
you don't care about that.
Well, it's a balance. I mean, because you're kind of aware that you know, it's how much do you explain and how much do you not explain, you know. What I liked about Central Station that I did hide in is a lot of references to obscure Israeli science fiction. And you know, only like three people would get those references. But they're still there. They're still there. So,
In the 90s, William Gibson said, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. But some years ago, when I interviewed Ian MacDonald, he said, well, that's not true, because at the moment, when an iPhone or a new Samsung comes out, you get the same exact thing from Mombasa to New York to Tokyo. So it's just that different people do different things with the actual technology. What do you think about that? Is the future coming everywhere or what?
Yeah, I don't think, yeah, I've always been puzzled by that remark about not evenly distributed. It's more, and I think Central Station, it's more that you have the past and the future together. And that's, you know, what you're saying is you can have a place with no running water, but they'll have 3G internet, you know. And, you know, and we can see it all around us. I mean, one of the things I'm interested in at the moment, it's kind of going off topic a bit, but is when the Roman conquest of Britain, you know. And what I was reading about is that the Romans very much treated, you know, because you have this advanced technological civilization going off to a place that's still in the Stone Age, roughly, you know. So their attitude to the Brits, to the Britons or whatever they were called, is very similar to that American science fiction attitude of you know, the Star Trek thing, when they go into a less advanced planet and kind of help them out, or uplifting and so on. So the Romans saw it the same way. We're going and we're kind of giving these guys, you know, hot baths and roads and so on. But again, you have that mix of cultures. So, you know, people still in the Roman Empire, they still coexisted with both the old and the new technology, the old and the new religions. And that's kind of what we have.
Yeah, but up to a certain time, the Western culture was one way to the non-developed countries. You know, there was like a flow of ideas, a flow of, yeah, let's say culture in all possible media forms. Now we see a two-way flow in the sense that a lot of things are coming back, for example, from China. A lot of things are coming back from South America. A lot of things are coming back from South Africa. You see more little flows coming back to the West as well. So it's a more complex chart. I do see this as a kind of positive change, even though we are far from being, you know, fairly.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it came down to the internet. That really is what allowed greater communication. And so, just to give an example, when we started editing, when I started WorldSF and the blog, there was hardly anything there. You had to hunt down writers. Sending stories, for example, was still incredibly hard. Cut to now, you know, we're coming around to doing the fifth volume. You'll find translations and outside writers writing in English. You'll find a mix, but you'll find them everywhere pretty much, you know. And you have sort of, suddenly you have Chinese writers winning a Hugo Award, which would have been unimaginable. You know, when I started the anthology, that was pretty much the first piece of Chinese science fiction published in the century, in, you know. And suddenly, you know, 10 years later, they go and win the Hugo Award. So it's changed immensely, you know. It's changed both by having people like myself, or like Aliette de Boudard, or like Hanu Rachaniemi, Rayaniemi. Yes. Yeah, and others writing in English. Also, you have to remember, a lot of people who don't necessarily come from the UK and the US, they still grow up with English. So there's a lot of I don't want to say non-Anglophone English, but, you know, you have a lot of people growing up in India who do speak English, so we have Indian writers coming onto the scene. And it's not an issue of translation, but at the same time, you know, they are English language writers who are not really seen. With the Indian writers, it's interesting, because there's always... if you are an Indian writer and you get published in English, it's because you've written a post-colonial novel, you know. That's the kind of selling point, you know, the post-colonial. And then you have these science fiction writers, you know, and they're like, I want to be a science fiction writer. Yeah. And no one wants an Indian science fiction writer, you know. Why don't you go and write a post-colonial novel? So it's very, very difficult in this field, you know. No one really wants what they want is for you to represent your culture. They don't want you to just write an adventure about aliens. So that's another challenge.
Over the last years, I've seen also a growth of national awards is it like 2 months ago they issued the first No More Words? No More is the dual divinity of the Dogon tribe in Africa, and that will represent the best speculative fiction from Africa. I've been to France, and they have the Grand Prix de l'Imaginaire, excellent prize. They have the Ig Nobel in Spain. Do you think that national prizes could be? We have the Urania Award, of course, in Italy. Do you think that national prizes could help track or at least identify some of the best voices in their each and every country? Another thing would be, and this is my personal advice, not just give the cash prize, but give the English translation as an award.
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't always work. I mean, I think in Israel, this is what they did. Yeah. It's what they have done this project to translate short stories. I don't think they've placed any of them in magazines, though. Okay. So it doesn't. So if we take that as a case example, that may not work. So it's the ones who won the prize. So what's popular amongst the people who vote for the prize is not necessarily what might be popular over in America. But you know, I think there should always be more prizes. I mean, a prize, basically the whole purpose of a prize is to help talk about something, you know, shine a focus on it. So, you know, it's great. I just don't think necessarily people pay a lot of attention to it, sadly, to any prize really.
Okay. More and more on the international scene, they are talking about this ambiguous word, diversity. Mm. This has been created, of course, by the Americans to try to carve a name out of what is not American, and is of course already creates a category. And in this diversity, gets a lot of people from other countries, other genders, other religions, other colors, otherness. I think it's not completely fair to identify whatever is not American as diverse, as a conceptual idea. But still, it is a first step to recognize that there is something beyond us or beyond them. It's the first. It's like you realize there are aliens, you know.
Well, I think my problem with it is that the discussion about diversity, I think, is a very important discussion, but it's still framed in American terms.
Yeah.
And in fact, they don't really. It doesn't really include non-Americans, you know. I mean, even being a British writer, is you're kind of excluded from the American sphere. So when they talk about diversity, they mean anything that is not standard American, but within America. So, you know, so if you're Italian, I don't know if it even factors in unless you're an Italian American.
What am I? Am I alien or not?
Well, you know, it's a lot more about kind of, you know, race and gender within the American context than it is about someone who gets translated. And it's frustrating. You kind of do feel that should be a part of it.
I could be Spanish for them.
Yeah, unless you're, you know, Latin America.
Latin America.
You always have to have American at the end of it.
Otherwise,
you don't count.
Yeah.
You know. So it is frustrating, but at the same time, you know, these things don't work alone. I mean, they all kind of, you know, intersect.
Yeah. Do you think that the Worldcon might help? I mean, the idea of a world convention, even though it has been placed for most of the times on the American soil, now it's starting to get out, and there is more and more request for conventions outside the U.S. Like in 2015, it was in London. This year, it will be in Helsinki. Probably in 2 years, it will be in Dublin. Still, they are very English-speaking countries. This is the point. They are selling us. Yeah, it's coming to Europe, but still, it's coming to English-speaking countries.
I mean, the problem is they call it a Worldcon, but it's still an American convention.
Yeah.
It's like the Hugos are an American convention, American awards, you know. So you can move the convention, but you need the people to move with the convention in a way. You know, from a writer's perspective or a work perspective, a convention is only really useful, you know, is if the editors and the agents and the publishers are all at the convention, and that's where you go to have meetings and to try and pitch or sell. So if those people don't come, and if those people are focused in selling New York and London, you know, it doesn't matter if you set the convention on the moon if they yeah. don't come. The problem is publishing, and if you think about the English publishing is actually owned by Germans and French. It's not even owned by, you know, by English speakers. But they are very, for novels especially, they're very risk averse and they're very commercially minded. So it's hard to sell anything that doesn't look like it's going to make money. And, you know, translations are always going to be a harder sell. What you want to happen is what happened with the Scandinavians when that girl with the dragon tattoo suddenly sold millions of copies that they, you know, and apparently they paid, you know, they paid a minimal advance for this book that they got. And suddenly it started selling, so everyone wanted Scandinavian crime. Whether it was good or not didn't really matter either. They just wanted what was hot. So, you know, you kind of want to see that effect with science fiction or with fantasy, but I don't think we've really seen it yet. You know, we had like a French fantasy novel published. We had a Polish, but you have one from each country. They don't really go, oh, we need to get all the Polish fantasy we can get our hands on. Let's chuck it out there. We haven't seen that effect.
Is there any question? We have 10 minutes left, or I shall have more question for Lavi and continue. No? Okay. Oh.
Importance of the work that you are doing online with the blog and you as a publishing or with the Urania Prize and so on is that even though there is internet and there is a lot of material, you need some kind of imprimatur, some kind of good quality assessment, because there is just so...
It's not quality assessment. No.
So, I mean, in this sense, Latin, a little bit. So, in this sense, this is important because, as you say, it's you that you look for people and ask, please give me this. And not, otherwise, if it is unsolicited, it's not that it's the unsolicitedness, but it's the fact that it's difficult to understand what, even in the self-publishing area in Italy, which is still very small, but there is a lot of offer, and it's difficult to say. So if I see something self-published, I might be tending in this direction. So I don't know if you, either of you or both of you can comment on this furthermore.
I personally publish the best authors from their countries. They have won all the major awards. Pepe Rojo writes for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Carmen Torres is the one of the most important science fiction writers in Catalonia. Olivier Paquet has won many times the Grand Prix de l'Imaginaire. Vajra Chandrasekara is the editor of Strange Horizons. So I put on the shelf on the same level people like Ian MacDonald and people like, as I said, these names of they are in their countries really the top you can find. So it's not a matter of a quality assessment. The quality assessment comes from me, yeah. From my choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. No,
okay,
so you need space monkeys. No. Why do you talk about self-publishing?
No, you said many people look for an imprimatur, for somebody who
this, I self-printed it, and I'm good.
Did you understand?
He was asking you if there is a way to do a different job, to have an incremental, to have a quality assessment, like first was the normal press editor.
No, I don't care about that.
You don't care about that. Okay, but I think his question was, what kind of job are you doing to change what once was given by a paper publisher as quality assessment? Okay, I'm investing in all this, so at least I think that it's good. But you're doing, for instance, you do it bringing online great names.
But you're talking from the writer perspective or the publisher perspective? I don't understand this.
On your perspective.
Mine as what?
He as an author and as a blogger, you as a kind of blog, and you as a, you are a publisher when you talk about the kind of stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, so.
So.
Now obviously, all categories are mixed.
No, not necessarily. What I don't understand the question.
Okay. Oh. I think that the nice thing about science fiction with short stories, which is different to most other genres, is that there are so many publications. You know, there are so many magazines, there are so many places that you can be published, starting from the ones that pay you a lot of money and would have, you know, very tough editors. Going down to, you know, a little online magazine that, but someone will publish you. I mean, Kurt Vonnegut has that thing about science fiction writers. He says it's impossible not to get published as a science fiction writer. He says doesn't matter how terrible your story is, someone will publish it. You know, which is a great thing to know when you're starting out. The problem with talking about editors and editors kind of filtering out quality, that, well, who's the editor? You know, who's the editor who's making the decisions, and what is he or she basing their decision on? You know, and I had this problem because I wasn't writing standard science fiction, and I was trying to sell to a magazine like Analog, which is the traditional hard SF American magazine that's been running for the past 70 years. And, you know, if you ask me how long it took me to sell a story to Analog, I will tell you it took me 35 years, which is how long the previous editor has been at the job. You know, I could not sell him a story. There was no way he would ever publish me. As soon as he left and they got a new editor in, I started being published in Analog. So I think the fact that we have a system where we don't have just one decision maker, that we have all these different magazines, different editors with different perspectives, opens up the field a lot more. We may not always like the same things. I mean, one of the reasons, after three anthologies that I did, I asked someone else to step in and choose the stories because I want someone else to bring their perspective to it. Because there are things that I don't like and I wouldn't want to publish, but someone else might like, you know. But I think with this series, if you look at the authors we published when they started out, a lot of them went on to become very big, you know, or to win awards, to get book deals. You know, Aliette Bodard is in the first one when she just started out. Lauren Bucus was in the second one, and Eddie Okorafor were in the second one, and that was way before they, you know, they started winning the awards and became massive names. So each one, you can kind of see the people. You know, Zen Cho is in
Han Song.
In volume 4. Han Song. Well, Han Song is still not well known, but I think that will be coming. Lu Shixin is one of the people I never included for various reasons, but I hope it will be in. But you can see that it wasn't just, oh, I'm just going to pick random international writers. I actually picked writers who went on to be important writers. So I don't think it's that hard to spot when something is good, you know. And then it becomes more a matter of personal taste. Do I personally like it or not? I don't know if that answers the question, but you will always get published as a science fiction writer.
So what's on the horizon now? What you're doing? You step out from the world science fiction blog and I'm very sorry about that. But will there be? No, I know you're not. But you did something, and probably somebody will take that place and continue what you've done. So, are you or still doing something about that apart from the Apex? You're going to issue more volumes of that?
Yeah, I mean, the blog was always just meant to promote the anthologies, and it just took a life of its own. And they started giving me prizes for it, which I didn't really want. So. Plus, it was exhausting work. It was, you know, it started out fun, but and we also did something called the World SF Travel Fund, where we paid for international writers to go to conventions, to the World Fantasy Convention, which is a more business convention. So we funded quite a few people, and then I stepped away from that. I don't know if that's going to, because it depended on fundraising every couple of years, and again, I just couldn't invest the time. The anthology series is still ongoing, though, so we had Volume 4 come out last year, which is edited by Mavish Murad, who is a Pakistani editor. So that was the first, I think that's the first anthology edited by a Pakistani woman of science fiction. And it happens to have, I think, Usman Malik is in it, who's the first Pakistani author to win a Stoker Prize, you know. So, I mean, the nice thing is because none of this happened before, it's always a first, you know. It's the first Chinese writer to win a Hugo. It's the first Pakistani writer to win a Stoker. There's so much to go. There's so much still to go. So the next step is, is to edit volume 5 of the anthology series. And my idea is to ideally have a different editor. I mean, I stay on, I supervise it, I do all the paperwork, all this hard work. But the idea is to ideally have different editors for each volume. So it's almost like a year's best type anthology. And we do them every couple of years if we can. Every time we do one, we just hope it makes enough money to justify, like, to put it into the next one.
Have you ever thought about crowdfunding?
Yeah, I just don't want to. We keep talking about it, but... Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I got a bit burnt out from doing the travel fund, I think. And also, I like the fact that it's quite a small operation. We could make it bigger, but I like that it's slim and it's quick and it's not, you know... But yeah, ideally I'd love to keep doing them. I mean, there's no reason to stop, and there's just more and more writers, and they look really nice on the shelf, the new editions.
Yes, so. they do. Yeah. If you need a hand, I'm here, okay? thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache della galassia. Da un'idea originale di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafini, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof. Massimo De Santo e la partecipazione straordinaria di Elisa Elena Carollo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.it, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @FantasciCast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/Fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/FSC Community. Se siete particolarmente timidi potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica, scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@Fantascientificast.it. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes, su Spotify e su Podbean all'indirizzo podcast.fantascientificast.it. Se volete potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal o Patreon utilizzando gli appositi pulsanti sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale, non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. Autorizzazione SIAE 56125359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. L'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augura lunga vita e prosperità e vi dà appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Potenza erogata 23%. così.
Blocco 2 è pronto.
Attivato.
Blocco 2 posizionato.
Siamo al 35%.
L'arme rossa, evacuare l'area intorno allo Stargate.
Liberate l'area, torniamo da voi, chiudo le porta.
Andiamo, sbrigate.
C'era quello sotto la grande pietra?
Sì. Mio padre lo trovò nel 1928. È fatto di un minerale che non si trova sulla Terra.
Blocco 5 posizionato.
75%.
Blocco 6 pronto. Blocco 6 posizionato.
Non eravamo mai riusciti ad andare oltre nella sequenza.
Blocco 7 è pronto.
Pronto, attivato.
Blocco 7 è posizionato.
Un'energia terrificante.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.